One thing Africa needs more of is stories about entrepreneurs, case studies detailing how the unique hustle and energy of this continent is being harnessed and used to shape businesses, to find opportunities and grow and eventually scale these into multi-million dollar enterprises. It's the stories that are out there in vast numbers, actually, but very few are telling them. Well, one of the few is Jaco Maritz, publisher of award-winning online platform How We Made It in Africa, who has just published his book of the same title. And Jaco, it's great to have you on the SME feature at long last. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, full disclosure, I first met you when you commissioned me to do some private equity app curation for you, but I'd often used the How We Made It in Africa website to draw inspiration. And you started out actually at a very well-known South African media company, Media 24. How did you end up founding Maritz Africa, which is the publisher of How We Made It in Africa?
To keep it short, after Media 24, I worked for a Nigerian business publication that had offices in Cape Town and Nigeria. And that led to a lot of travel to Nigeria and other countries in the continent. And it just created an interest in the business opportunities in the rest of the continent. And then in 2010, I started How We Made It in Africa.
And what is the basic model of How We Made It in Africa?
We profile entrepreneurs on the continent, and we also write about business trends. So it's more real economy focused and the people behind the businesses than necessarily focused on stock prices and things like that.
That's the beauty of it. There's a disconnect, I think, very often between stock markets and capital markets in Africa and the hustle and what's really going on the ground. In fact, in the opening preface to the book, you mention that story of meeting an entrepreneur on the streets of Lagos who was just ready to service you, basically, on the side of the road, working from what we would largely, from a formal economy viewpoint, tend to dismiss. But that is very much Africa for you from the grassroots of it. But as you say in your book, from a $50 million food and retail empire to an instant noodle pioneer, there are a range of different stories. You've documented 22 odd stories of entrepreneurs making it across the continent. And there are five lessons that we've sort of gleaned or that we can learn from the entrepreneurs profiled in the book. Let's start with the first one that you've taken out here. And that's just to take time to formulate the why of your business. It sometimes seems fairly self-evident. But how has this come out through your research and through the book, How We Made It in Africa?
I think when starting out, a lot of entrepreneurs have a rough idea of where they want to take the company. But as they are confronted with the real world realities and challenges, it becomes little more than a battle for survival. And the original vision and mission typically become little more than PR tools or words on the company website. One entrepreneur that we profiled, Ken Joroge, who started a Pan-African digital payments company called Silicon, he is especially inspiring in this regard. He and his partner started the business 15 years ago. They actually decided on a goal of what they wanted before they were even 100% certain through what type of business they would achieve it. And the goal was to build a $1 billion company. Now, to say you want to build a $1 billion company sounds a bit silly, but they picked this goal because they were particularly interested in driving Maseratis. For them, it symbolized something bigger. It was to dispel the myth that Africans can't do anything for themselves and to demonstrate that it is possible to build a world-class company without political connections or paying bribes. And when I asked him why $1 billion and not, for instance, $100 million or $10 million, which would be equally respectable. Sure. He said that $10 million is not enough because a friend of a politician can relatively easily accumulate $10 million. Even $100 million, a few guys who stole oil in Nigeria or Angola could achieve that. But no one can argue that a billion-dollar company is a world-class operation. So that was their goal. That is their why for the business. And every decision from who to employ to what processes they put in place, everything cracks towards that goal. They started the ringtones business where they were selling mobile ringtones, and they launched into mobile payments because even though the ringtones business was going well, like it wasn't big enough to take them to $1 billion. So every single decision they make is to reach this $1 billion goal, and they are actually well on their way to achieve that.
And it's incredible, as you mentioned in the book, that they started working from a small, dirty kitchen in an upmarket Nairobi suburb so that they could say that their address is at least in a cool area of Nairobi. But once again, speaks to that point of presenting a successful front to the outside world. I think often entrepreneurs are like the proverbial duck, all calm and serene above the water below, paddling frantically. Now, your second lesson that you've teased out here is that entrepreneurs should focus on growing the business and not get too involved in the day-to-day operations. And I think very often, certainly in the scale-up phase, this is where businesses can tend to fail.
Yeah, this lesson comes from a homegrown entrepreneur, Timmy Parker, who started Zenzele Fitness, and they basically run health clubs or gyms in corporate offices. So, for example, they run the gym in the new Discovery building. They've got APSA and Alexander Forbes and people like that as their clients. And he basically said that when starting out, he made a conscious decision a scalable business, a company that would grow big. I think many entrepreneurs, they start out as sort of without like a clear goal of where they want to see it and sort of that it will become big by itself. And he contrasts that with the sole proprietor approach, and he gives the example of a restaurateur who is happy to have one restaurant where they spend all their time and they know all their customers by name. So their first gym was at an SAB brewery. And he tells a story when they first opened that health club, someone told him that he now needs to be the club manager and he needs to ensure that there's paper in the toilet and that the floor isn't wet. But he quickly learned that if he was to get involved in such small details, the company would never grow. His job is rather to find another SAB and another one and another one and leave the operations of the individual gyms to his operations manager.
And right now, they are certainly riding that that wellness wave. They started well ahead of the curve on that one. Another interesting insight is that those entrepreneurs do tend to have an eye for the gap and an unwavering self-belief to take it. The third lesson that you've teased out amongst all of these entrepreneurs, the sort of golden thread, is that all stakeholders in a business or in a business deal or transaction should have skin in the game. It's all about aligning interests.
Yes, this one comes from one of the profiles on Chijioke Dozie. He's a Nigerian entrepreneur and investor. And he learned this lesson when they invested in a distressed company. So it was a company in trouble, and they thought if they give them some money, they can turn it around. But the owner didn't have the same incentive as these new investors to see the business succeed, because either way, he was making money from this deal because they invested in his business. And Dozy said that they've made the mistake to go into a few such transactions because they seemed exciting. But in every one of these situations where not everyone at the same ultimate goal for a business, that they've lost money.
And I think that can be said for, I think, so many of us, even in formal employment. Often when you negotiate a contract with your employer, you're not aligning interests. There's only ever going to be one winner in that outcome. The fourth golden thread that you've woven through all of these is the lesson on the introduction of new products. Don't introduce new products or services before the current ones are well established. And it comes back to an earlier point you made around establishing the why and focusing on growing the business. It's about having this laser-like focus on doing one thing exceptionally well before you move on to another.
Yes, that one comes from a Rwandan entrepreneur, John Kahabo, and he started out manufacturing toilet paper in Rwanda. And he made the mistake to introduce detergents not long after he started the toilet paper manufacturing. And detergents sold well. The raw materials that he had to import was very expensive, and he had to dip into capital that was actually meant for the toilet paper side of the business, which meant that his original product suffered. And I think this is something that a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with, because you start out and then in the first year or two, sales might not be what you expected. And then you think, oh, maybe I've got the wrong product. Maybe I need to do something else. Maybe I need to diversify. But what he says is that when developing a business plan for a particular product, entrepreneurs need to have a clear idea of the size of the market that they are targeting. So upfront, you need to know what the opportunity is. And if that opportunity is large enough, it is important to stick to that one product until it can stand on its own feet before branching out. So focus on one thing until it can sustain itself.
It is the value of some of that 2020 hindsight vision that comes through in his story, but also the fact that he showed great grit and determination starting his business as he did not too long after the tragedy of the Rwandan genocide and what that country was going through as well. It just has a great resonance for us in South Africa at the moment. Not that we're going through a genocide, but boy, it feels like we've reached peak pessimism. It just shows you that entrepreneurs just tend to get on with it and don't let the headlines and the noise get in their way. And then finally, your lesson is not to market your product. Let your product market itself, because no amount of advertising can sell a bad product, which seems trite, but it's absolutely true.
Yes, the entrepreneur who said that is Nana Akua Berme. She is the founder of one of Ghana's most successful architecture firms. And her company faces a unique challenge in that architecture firms, like law firms in Ghana, are not allowed to advertise or market their services. And her response was basically to let buildings do the advertising for them. And she reasoned that if someone really liked the building and they wanted the company to design something similar to them, that they would find out who designed that and fish them out. And she says, not only true for architecture firms, but for all entrepreneurs, that to attract new clients, the fundamental thing is the product. You can hire the best ad agency in the world, but if what you offer is no good, the result of the advertising will also be zero. So let your work speak for itself, basically.
Well, Jaco, I think in terms of what you've offered, along with one of your writers at How We Made It in Africa, Justin Probin, it certainly is a fascinating glimpse into the world and the life of the entrepreneur who's hustling across the African continent, but not at a micro scale either. A lot of these businesses as you said earlier on, well on their way to becoming billion-dollar, as we'd call them, unicorns, and showing exactly how these entrepreneurs did it in some very difficult and different circumstances to what you might find in the developed world. Just a last word for business partners, I see, and the UCT School of Business. I see they were critical supporters of this project.
Yeah, they were our sponsors project, and we're very glad to have them on board, and they certainly made seeing a book much easier.
And how can listeners get their dirty, grubby mitts on a copy, Yaku? Is it only available as an ebook? I downloaded mine as an ebook, or is it going to be in stores soon?
It's only available as an ebook on book.howwemadeitinapp.com. We are launching a print version on 8 November, but we will see in terms of how wide we distribute it, or if we just sell it online. That's yet to be decided. But at the moment, it's only an ebook.
Yaku, thanks for your time. We're going to have to leave it there. A great pleasure chatting to you as always, and keep bringing us those stories of the hustlers and entrepreneurs who are just getting on with it and making a difference across Africa. Take care.
Thank you very much, Michael.
That was Yaku Maritz, founder of Maritz Africa and author of his newly published book, How We Made It in Africa, sharing some of those lessons that can be gleaned from the various entrepreneurs that have been profiled in the book. As I said, 22 among them. Let's cross now to Pusaletso to get the latest traffic update.